Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 517. Science Faction, your weekly corona update. These are the numbers for today, November 29th, 2020. Worldwide infected, 62.9 million. U.S. infected, 13.64 million. Worldwide deaths, 1.46 million. U.S. deaths, 272,500. U.S. is still, of course, greatly leading the world in overall deaths. By the way, the U.S. is now in the worst part of the pandemic we've ever been in. We have now topped more than 200,000 new infections per day and climbing, and about 2,000 deaths a day and climbing. Now, that's a little bit weird because the way they do the averages, they kind of spike up and down a little bit, but we are about to beat our all-time death record, which was back in the late spring, when we were having less infections, but we were worse at treating it. So we have way more infections than we'd ever had, and we're getting up to the point where we're about to have way more deaths than we've ever had. So this is the worst of it. You know, while we think we have may have lived through it 6 months ago, the worst of it is literally as you are listening to me right now. As we started talking about a few weeks ago, we were looking at U.S. active cases where we are blowing everybody else out of the water at 5.3 million. France is next up with less than 2 million. And then after that, the highest up is like a couple hundred thousand. So we are in really, really bad shape in terms of active cases, which is being reflected in daily new positive cases and daily death rates. Obviously, right now, the U.S. is a war zone. Like, if you're in another country and you're thinking of coming here, I like think people should be in Liberia looking at us being like, I don't want to go to that shithole. That place is dangerous. Like, this Somali pirates that were looking forward to like Trump getting kicked out of office so maybe they could claim asylum are like, no, that place is dangerous. Sure, the education system is good, but who would want to do that? I like the idea that other countries are looking at the U.S. now the way the U.S. military contractors were looking at Iraq a couple of years ago, where they're like, yeah, I got out of the army and now I'm in private service and I can make, you know, 300 grand a year if I go off to Iraq, but it's real dangerous. Also, we are leading the world in serious and critical cases with 24.6 thousand serious or critical cases right now, things that are so bad that there are anecdotal reports of times in which every ICU bed in Arizona is taken up and places in the Dakotas are actually shipping some of their patients to other states because they've literally ran out of beds for them. The number two up, again, we have almost 25,000 serious or critical cases currently in the United States. India is second with 9,000, and they have three times our population, and their GDP per capita is like one-tenth of ours. So this is a world problem, but this is a staunchly U.S. crisis in this point. All right, first article, the curse continues. So I talked last week about how it seems like when I put out an episode, less than 12 hours later, a new phase three vaccine candidate's results are released. And many of you guys were listening to that episode on Monday morning as a new vaccine candidate's phase three results were released. So, you know, this is one of those curses that I'm happy for. I'm just going to keep saying this over and over again with the hopes that by the end of this show, we have like 50 different vaccines. So maybe I'm doing something well. We talked last week about the Moderna vaccine coming out. That was another mRNA vaccine similar to the Pfizer one that had. And right after we released that episode and published that episode, they came out with the phase three results for the Oxford/AstraZeneca vaccine, which was found to be 70 to 90% effective depending on the dosage. Now, this is an interesting one. This is not an mRNA vaccine. There's some positives to that, meaning it can be just kept refrigerated. They expect to have like 4 billion doses by the end of 2021, et cetera, et cetera. It's also a two-dose vaccine, just like the other two, but instead of an mRNA, they use an adenovirus, which we've talked about before. This is what the Russians use. It's basically a similar virus that causes the common cold. They make some modifications to it. So A, it can no longer be infectious. It can no longer get you sick. It can't really replicate in the same way. But number two, they also tag that spike protein on there, that ACE2 spike protein on there, and that lets your body get used to the binding site that it will be looking for if it gets exposed to SARS-CoV-2. This is basically the same idea that the Russian vaccine follows. And probably they used a lot of the same research because, as we talked about earlier in the summer, the Russians actually hacked the British to look at their vaccine trials and results and stuff. So instead of doing their own science, they just kind of like broke in and copied the homework of somebody else. So this is probably very derivative of the same stuff that we're seeing in the Russian cases. What was very interesting, I think the most interesting story about this, that was not really covered well in the media. So the general overall effectiveness was only ranked at 62%. However, one subset group had a 90% effectiveness, and that subset group was a mistake. This is so interesting. So again, two-shot virus, you take it 28 days apart. But in this case, the first shot that was given, because of a manufacturing issue, there was a manufacturing mistake where each of the vials was only made with about half of the dosage that they intended to give for that first shot. And that group ended up having a way higher effectiveness, 90% effectiveness, kind of on par with what we're seeing with Moderna and Pfizer. How is that possible, you might say? How did you go from 62% effectiveness to 90% effectiveness by fucking up and giving somebody less of a dosage in that first shot? And there's a lot of theories as to why. One of the interesting ones that I have heard that seems at least somewhat plausible is that when you have the full dosage on the first shot, that trains the immune system to be so overwhelmingly strong and gives such an overwhelmingly strong response that when it gets the second shot 28 days later, it basically completely eradicates the virus that's in there, the adenovirus that's in there, before it can get re-exposed to the spike protein enough to actually kind of re-up the immune system or bump it up. And so you're essentially only getting like a one-shot vaccine at that point. Whereas with half of the load, it's more of mimicking kind of what you get in a lot of natural situations your immune system is used to, where you're exposed to a virus where it's a little bit at first and the virus starts replicating more and more and more. And so you get more and more. Again, this can't really replicate in your system, so you're not going to continue to get more. The most you're going to have is the second they shoot into your arm. There's going to be less and less every minute after that. And so by doing it in a way where you start with less and then increase to more, you have a better chance for more of your immune system to be trained to locate and destroy that spike protein. We're still not sure. Maybe it's actually a mistake in the numbers. When you divide it up to the small sample that got the half virus load in the very beginning, it looks like the sample size gets small enough where you have a lot of questions. But it could be that a mistake has actually showed us the way to do this better, which is actually a fairly common thing in science and really, really neat. Very interesting story about this vaccine that for whatever reason is not getting told nearly enough, but I think it's the most interesting part of this vaccine. Again, some other interesting parts: doesn't have the need for that deep cold that we talked about at the mRNA vaccines can last a long time, like 6 months in a regular refrigerator. So very interesting and incredibly cheap, like $3 a dose as opposed to about $20 a dose for the mRNA ones. So there's an idea that this is going to be what will help places like Africa and parts of South America and parts of Southeast Asia and stuff that are A, they don't have the cold chain storage, and B, they don't have the GDP per capita to afford very expensive things. So it might be that even if this was like 85% effective, if you can get way more people dosed, again, like 4 billion doses by the end of 2021, if you get way more people dosed with 80% effectiveness, that's better than getting, you know, half as many people dosed with 95% effectiveness. There were no serious side effects attributed to the vaccine, though this is the one we talked about a few months back that was temporarily stopped in phase 3 trials, when what is now believed to be an unrelated neurological condition was discovered in two separate individuals throughout the trial. It is now thought that that's just a statistical anomaly and doesn't really have anything to do with the vaccine. Who knows? We will figure that out, I guess, as time goes on. Now, as you guys are listening to this, maybe they've released phase 3 on some other trials. We are still waiting in terms of major U.S. companies putting out vaccines. We're still waiting on Johnson & Johnson's vaccine, which is another weakened adenovirus vaccine, so not an mRNA one. So it's similar to this one, this Oxford AstraZeneca one that just came out. And to me, the one that I'm really waiting for, the one that's most exciting to me, is the Novavax vaccine, which is actually different from all of these. It's not an mRNA. It's not an adenovirus. It's not a weakened virus one. None of those. This is one we discussed a few weeks back that uses nanoparticles, so completely manufactured particles, inert particles. These are not living things. This is not a modified virus. This is not a piece of mRNA that your body's taking in. It's like you built a plastic ball and you stuck that spike protein all over it. It seems in some cases, because they can, you know, put a lot of spike proteins on it and your body is, you know, focusing on just those spike proteins because there's nothing else, you know, no living material in it otherwise, it seems like that might actually be a much more effective vaccine. Some of the early studies seem to show it could be up to 10 times as effective as a normal vaccine. No idea yet how that compares to something like an mRNA vaccine, because obviously they couldn't compare them. We haven't had mRNA vaccines yet, but very, very interesting. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing what happens when Novavax comes out. out, especially with some of the modifications they are making to these nanoparticle-type vaccines, which is, again, totally new type. Similar to mRNA vaccines, have never been done before, but have shown amazing possibilities in the lab. So I'm really interested in that. Hopefully, as you hear me right now, you'll be paging through the internet and looking at phase 3 trials of either Novavax or Johnson & Johnson, because the curse will continue, and there will be a new one released right after I publish this episode. All right, article number 2, and this is a really interesting article that I also think flew way under the radar. This comes from the publications of the National Academy of Sciences, again, Damien's favorite journal, PNAS, and it looks at outbreak data to see which avoidance measures were most effective in which situations. And you might think you know the answer to this, and I think this might surprise you. So, obviously, physically distancing was most effective. And physically distancing doesn't have a set number. It is not, by the way, the 6 feet you hear. That is like a minimum type thing. We're talking about being out of the range of somebody else's small aerosolized particles. That means in certain circumstances, it might be, you know, 4 meters away, but in some, it might be 25 feet away. If someone's sneezing or coughing or something like that, you have to take into account if they're indoors, that totally changes things because stuff seems to accumulate indoors. You have to look at ventilation and stuff, but it's basically, the definition would be being out of the vicinity of somebody's viral particles. And you could tell that that will be very effective because we know that while you can get it from touching surfaces, that's quite rare. For the most part, people are getting sick because they're getting sick by sharing somebody's infected air, specifically a lot of times with people who don't know they're infected because they're either asymptomatic or presymptomatic. So the first thing they found was physical distancing is obviously the best in essentially any case, because if you can stay far away and you can keep from being infected, then obviously you're not going to catch it and infect anybody else. But then they looked at things like strict social bubbles, which only really work when they're strictly adhered to. And the problem is they're very rarely strictly adhered to, especially in America, where, as Superfan Dwayne put it, we have a national case of oppositional defiant disorder, which is, again, still the most 100% right-on thing somebody has said about an American in a long time, where we not only won't do it, but even if we say we're going to do it, we love to make exceptions for ourselves. Yes, 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 we'll only stay within our family, but it's Thanksgiving, so we're going to go see the cousins and that kind of thing. So all of that will lead to the idea that a non-strict social bubble won't really work. You'll essentially still pass it around. But in certain situations, those bubbles, when strictly adhered to, will help contain epidemics. Specifically when you're in places where you are really inundated with the virus. So if you're, let's say you're talking about schools. If you have schools where you're in, let's say, a typical high school, these kids go from class to class to class, they're indoors, it's now wintertime, the heater's on, the windows are closed, everybody's crammed in there, the air has less humidity into it, and it's very cold, both things that are good for viral transmission. When all of that is taken into account, well, think about it, there's not strict social bubbles, right? Because you go from math class to history class to English class, you're with different kids each time, now it's spreading around. In those situations, things like physical barriers like masks might not be nearly as helpful as things like strict social bubbles. You might think, wait, what? Why could that not be effective? Well, think about it. Again, take the high school students. Let's say all those kids keep their masks on the entire time, they're wearing it right, et cetera, et cetera, and we all know that there's going to be 2 or 3 fuck-ups in there who aren't. But let's say they are. Well, when somebody, even one of those kids in that classroom, is sitting in that classroom for long enough, even with that mask on, they are still pluming out a whole bunch of viral particles. That is still basically creating a cloud around them of that virus. And even if your mask is, let's say you have a great mask, you have an N95, it's 95% effective. Well, 5% of that air has way more than enough viral particles to get you sick. So you're still going to get sick. Now, it does matter. Remember, we talk about viral load, initial viral load being a thing. So it's not necessarily going to stop you from getting sick, but it might very well stop you from getting badly sick, from being in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not saying don't wear masks in those situations. Absolutely, please God, wear masks. It cuts down your transmission and what you take in and everything like that. But now that kid is sick and all the kids in the classroom that are close, within a close proximity of him, are sick. And then all those kids go off to different classrooms and spread it. Whereas if you were in a strict social bubble, let's take, for instance, a young elementary school child who gets into one classroom in the morning and stays in that classroom the entire day. Well, then all of a sudden that stays within that bubble. And yeah, all those kids around them will still likely get sick, but they won't spread it to all the kids in the school. So what's interesting about this paper is it looked at different situations, depending on whether you are exposed in very high risk situations, things like with that aforementioned classroom or bars or clubs, et cetera, et cetera. Low risk situations where you're just passing by somebody outdoors, in which case a strict social bubble isn't going to protect you the most, because if you're just passing by somebody outdoors, they're not in your strict social bubble. What's going to help you best there is obviously physical distance, which is always the best way, but also a mask, which in those situations could very likely keep you from getting sick because you're no longer, you know, sitting in the cloud of that bubble of virus. Instead, you pass by somebody who otherwise you would have breathed in their air, but they're wearing a mask and you're wearing a mask, so it filters out enough that 95% is enough to keep you from getting any viral particles so you don't get sick. So in certain situations, especially low risk ones, things like masks are very effective at preventing infections altogether. In very inundated situations, ER hospitals, high school classrooms, bars, clubs, etc., masks are very good at preventing you from having a huge viral load, but they're not necessarily the best option at preventing you from becoming a chain in the epidemic as much as, you know, a strict social bubble would. And that's just because you'll be exposed to less of those people. So very, very interesting. And something I really want to stress here, because I think this is a common misconception. We just reviewed how the mask is not 100%. Both people wearing a mask is not 100%. If you are in a situation where you are indoors in close contact with not necessarily great ventilation with many people, it is essential you wear a mask. It's essential you wear the best mask you can get. You keep it on the whole time. You keep it over your nose and your mouth, et cetera, et cetera. But that is not a force field. You are still actually quite likely to get sick overall, and that depends on your amount of time exposed in that area, how many viral particles in that area, ventilation, all that other stuff. But you still have a quite decent likelihood of getting sick. I think this is really important for everybody out there to hear and tell their family and friends. Because I know, you know, this is something that I've seen in my own family, is people believe that that mask is your magic protective cloak that will keep you from getting sick. It can in certain circumstances, but especially indoor ones, it absolutely is not a magic cloak. It absolutely is not foolproof. In fact, in some cases, even when both people are wearing really good masks that are well-fitted, et cetera, you are still quite likely to, depending on how long you stay there, inevitably going to get sick. Think about that. Remember, physical distancing is really the only thing we can say works in basically all situations. If you can physically stay away from people, and that includes if you're indoors staying away from things like the ventilation that you might not even know is coming into your room, but actually staying away from infectious people, even those who are pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, is really the only thing you can do. And since we don't know who's pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, you just have to stay away from people in general. In situations where you're going to be exposed to those people in dangerous situations, then strict social bubbles are actually our best protective agent, in addition to the mask, obviously, but our best protective agent in terms of keeping an outbreak from happening at any given time. Very interesting. Please let people know this. Remember this yourself, that mask is going to do a lot more for you. If you're passing by somebody on the street in a 6-foot distance and you guys are wearing masks, you're probably going to be okay. Not 100%, but probably going to be okay. That goes way downhill the second you're stuck in a small grocery store or indoor location with those people, and thinking that, you know, you're going out to a bar or a restaurant and you're going to be safe because you're wearing a mask is silly, frankly. Again, you still want to do it. Viral load is a big deal. You getting exposed to 5% of somebody's virus as opposed to 95% very well could be the difference between you dying and staying alive and whatnot. But if you don't want to get sick in the first place, don't want to provide a chain of transfer for this, then it's very important you remember that mask is not some force field that's going to protect you all the time. All right, thank you so much for coming back for Science Faction 517, where you learned all about how Science Faction is constantly producing new vaccines simply by reporting on the old ones, and how different strategies will impact the spread of a virus in different circumstances around you, including some surprising news about masks. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back later this week for Science Faction 518.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.